The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is 2:45 in the afternoon of Wednesday, May the 9th, 2007. We have a quorum here to conduct business. Senator Huggins is here, Senator Wilkowski, myself, Senator French. I just want to let the public know that I'm sorry about the delay, but it's the time of year when a G is being held and heard in one part of the building and important bills in the other, and it's tough to get a group here. Thank you, Senator Huggins, for coming down and helping us get started with a quorum. We have bills up. HB 90 is first up. And do we have a representative spokesman for the bill? I think just entering stage left. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Huggins. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Carpenetti. When you get ready, we'll have you come forward, put yourself on the record, talk to us about HB 90.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. HB 90 was introduced by Representative Ralph Samuels with a bail provision that was intended to do some fine tuning on a statute that was passed last year, trying to avoid serial bail hearings. We spoke with Representative Samuels, and he agreed to add some other fine tuning and embellishment. Actually, House Bill 90 really does do some fine tuning on legislation that has been passed in the last 4 or 5 years by the legislature. And if you would, you like me to just review them, or
if
what
you
is
mind,
best
maybe,
for you?
Maybe just walk us through the bill, and whatever. I'm not sure what manner you choose to do so, but if we can just get an overview of the sections and what they do,
I'll
so
be glad
that Senator Wilkowski and I are up to speed.
Okay. Section 1 creates a new crime, violation by sex offender of condition of probation or parole. And the reason is, when the legislature adopted Senate Bill 218 last session, which adopted a much longer sentences for felony sex offenders and periods of probation, there's a possibility under the statute now that since there are mandatory minimum terms of probation, that an individual that has been sentenced to jail and has been released on probation or parole will run out of time hanging over their head to enforce their conditions of probation and parole, like taking periodic polygraphs and making sure they don't move into a new area without letting their probation or parole officer know. So this statute is to have an enforcement mechanism for felony sex offenders who are on probation or parole who do not abide by the conditions of parole that are considered to be important in order to safeguard the public and to try and at least delay reoffense.
And on that point, it's not as if we're adding a new condition of their probation. We're not adding to their sentence. There's no double jeopardy issue here. We're simply saying now, if you violate one of the conditions we gave you at your sentencing, that will be an offense, and you'll be prosecuted for that.
Yes, and it only applies to those sex offenders who have no time remaining on their original sentence. Section 2 improves the crime of electronic distribution of indecent material, which was adopted a couple years ago, and that statute prohibits a person from sending indecent material depicting a minor to minors. Our sex offender prosecutor has found that predators send pictures of themselves or other adults to minors, so this would prohibit sending indecent materials depicting both adults and minors for that offense. Section 3 is really a conforming section. It allows forfeiture of a computer or other equipment used in the electronic distribution of indecent material to minors. Section 4 is a provision that was suggested by our cold case prosecutor. The legislature recently funded a cold case prosecutor for our office, and we have been investigating old murders, and our prosecutor suggested that it would be a very helpful tool in the prosecution of these old cases to be able to charge attempt, conspiracy, and solicitation of murder. Unfortunately, the statute of limitations for those offenses is 5 years, so for the very old cold cases, we're unable to charge that. Section 5 is the original House Bill 90, which does attempt to limit serial bail hearings by requiring a person to requiring basically a person at their bail hearing to bring as much information as they can, so that we're not bringing victims back day after day to add more information to see whether this might convince a judge to let you out.
Ms. Carpenter, let me just stop you and welcome Senator McGuire to the committee. It's she just joined us a moment ago. Thank you, Senator McGuire. I know you're very busy. How'd your bill go?
Passed. Oh, and it passed.
Yay. Please proceed.
Section 6 of the bill puts into statute standards for when a court, when a judge can award time against a sentence of imprisonment for a period of time spent in a treatment program. The purpose is to put it into statute so that courts will generally be a little bit more uniform throughout the state in awarding credit against a sentence for time spent in a treatment program, and to make it fair in terms of what does qualify for credit against a term of imprisonment. The three basic requirements is that first, the court has to order the person to this treatment program before he or she decides to go. The treatment program must meet standards that are set out in the bill, which are pretty much similar to what the court has already adopted in cases like the Nygren case. And the person can only get credit for those days that the director of the program tells the judge the person actually participated in for the day and cooperated with the treatment program.
Now, just for my own edification, this is in no way related to electronic monitoring and home arrest and folks who are spending jail sentences at home under house arrest.
No, this is for credit against it that a judge awards against a sentence for time spent in a treatment program.
Okay. Thank you.
Section 7 does provide, Section 7 is also a fix that's needed in response to Senate Bill 218, because Senate Bill 218 adopted mandatory minimum terms of probation for felony sex offenders. And for example, for rape, the mandatory minimum term of probation is 15 years, but our current statute sets out 10 years maximum probation for all crimes. So this would allow the court to impose the 15 years mandatory minimum or more for a sex offender probation. Section 8 adds the electronic distribution of indecent materials to a minor to those crimes that require registration as a sex offense. Section 9 addresses applications for post-conviction relief. The state over the past 10 or 12 years has really made good progress in eliminating lawsuits filed by prisoners, kind of recreational litigation. And one of the things that it's done is adopted a limit of one post-conviction relief application after you're convicted and your conviction is upheld on direct appeal. Our courts have held in the Granoles case that a person has the right, fairness requires a person to be able to bring a second application for post-conviction relief so that a person may litigate a claim that his or her attorney in the first petition was not effective. This section just provides that the person in that second application for post-conviction relief has to file it within a year of the final decision on the first one, to try and avoid, 20 years out bringing an application for post-conviction relief, to try and limit those. Section 10 provides that a person may not be awarded good time by the Department of Corrections for any period spent in a treatment program, in a private residence, or under electronic monitoring.
So if you're sentenced to 20 days in jail, you've got to do 20 days of treatment or 20 days of home arrest or 20 days of electronic monitoring. It's not as if you get the one-third deduction that you get if you're in a correctional facility.
Yes, that's correct. And actually, Ms. Griffin is here from Corrections, and she has testified in the past, and she can correct me if I'm wrong, that you don't, there are no treatment programs that Corrections sends you to as part, that isn't in connection with probation and parole, so you wouldn't be getting good time for that anyway. So it really is not a change in current practice. It does clarify that you don't get good time for time spent in a home or under electronic monitoring outside the prison.
Senator McGuire has a question.
Yeah, I just through the chair on the policy behind this, So, you know, the reasons for doing it that we have been explained in past years are that it cuts costs. In some cases, to have a person who has a low likelihood of recommitting, if you will, I don't know what all the conditions are, but to be on electronic monitoring. So are we going to be deterring people from taking that path? Is that the, what's the goal? Is the goal to make them go to the hard jail cell and not do this?
Through the chair, no. The goal is to, the purpose of Good Time has always been a tool for corrections to encourage good behavior of prisoners in jail. Good Time, so if a Department of Corrections releases somebody to serve a part of his or her sentence at home under electronic monitoring, that's really not jail. You don't have the encouragement. You don't need to. The rationale for Good Time doesn't really apply to a person who's outside of jail.
Okay.
And, you know, most prisoners would choose 30 days of electronic monitoring as opposed to 20 days in jail.
Okay.
And let the record reflect that Senator Theriault has joined us. Thank you, Senator Theriault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My apologies for being late.
And lastly, the applicability of the Section 11.
Oh, okay. The Nygren credit provisions are applied to sentences imposed on or after the effective date of the if this bill passed, the effective date of the act. But it could apply to crimes committed before that, but only to sentences imposed afterwards. Section 9, which is the limitation on post-conviction relief applications, applies to persons who are in jail who have been convicted before on or after the effective date.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenetti. Questions or comments about the bill? We do have some amendments proposed. Let's start with them. The top one is not numbered or labeled, but it says offered in the House. It pertains to page 3, line 28. And it would deletes what's on lines 29 and 30 of page 3. Let's title that amendment number 1. I will move it if someone would object.
Object.
It's been moved and objected to amendment number 1. Amendment removes this line that says information the defendant knew about but did not present at a previous bail review hearing. We have heard from both the Public Defender's Office and the Office of Public Advocacy that this will potentially create a series of conflicts between a defendant and his or her defense counsel that they would just as soon avoid. I think they were a bit chagrined that it got through the House without them objecting, and they've had to do a fair amount of work, I think, with the bill's sponsor to convince them that it was also a problem, but I believe that has happened. And that this amendment is supported by the sponsoring representatives. Is that correct? Head nod. Thank you very much. So, with that, Senator Wilkowski, do you maintain your objection?
Yes. No, I don't.
Senator Wilkowski has withdrawn his objection. Is there any other objection to Amendment Number 1? Senator Terry, I'll give you a moment. Do you need another moment or more discussion?
No, I'm just. I think if we just do it with a little bit in a conceptual, just so that the grammar and drafting gets done right, because
it should read now, and the reason, beginning on line 26, it should read now, and the reason the information was not presented at a previous hearing. In this paragraph, new information does not include the inability to post the required bail, and it would continue with a semicolon.
Okay, I think it's right then. No objection.
Then with amendment number 1 is passed. We have other amendments brought to us by Senator Wilkowski. Senator Wilkowski, I'll turn to you now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are 3 amendments, and I think probably the best way to do this is if you look in the upper right-hand corner, they're all dated. Actually, they're not all dated, but there's an 0.1, an 0.3, and an 0.4, and I think it's probably just easiest to take it in that order.
All right.
0.1, Luckup, dated 5307. I would move that as amendment number 2.
I'll object for the purposes of discussion. What does the amendment do, Senator Wilkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That amendment, currently the statute of limitations for kidnapping is 10 years, and kidnapping is an unclassified felony. There are many other serious unclassified felonies where the statute of limitations is unlimited. This would change the statute of limitation for all kidnapping to unlimited and put that in line with other unclassified felonies.
With that, I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to amendment number two?
Good.
Seeing and hearing none, amendment number two is adopted. And let's just take a brief at ease. Back on the record. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move amendment number three, 0.3, Luckup, dated 5807.
And just a general description of the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment stems from the case that probably many of us are familiar with, the Bonnie Craig crime that occurred, and the defendant had been in jail, and had there been DNA samples that had been taken and processed, then we would have found the person much earlier than it took. And so I've worked in conjunction with Ms. Foster on this, and Ms. McGuire is also, Senator McGuire has also been very helpful on this, and trying to close these loopholes. And what this amendment does is it requires that DNA samples that are taken be processed within 90 days. What we've found is that there are about 2,700 DNA samples that have been taken. However, they have not been processed yet. And I believe we have Ms. Foster on the phone. She's been online since, I think, 1:30. And so, if with your indulgence, Mr. Chair, if we could hear from her, I would greatly appreciate it.
I think that's a good idea. Ms. Foster, can you are you still on the line and can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you, and I'm present.
Please put yourself on the record. Just tell us your name and your affiliation, if any, and then we'd be happy to hear your testimony about this proposed amendment.
I am Karen Foster, Bonnie Craig's mother. First of all, I do want to thank you all for your service to our state and the community, and I commend you all because I know you've dedicated a lot of your life to our state. I know it's not an easy job, and I would not want to be in your shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your service. Over the last couple of days, I know that you have all been inundated with my emails and emails from everybody else in our state regarding this DNA profiling. I encourage you to make sure we give law enforcement the tools they need to perform their jobs efficiently and effectively. With the proper legislation, we can significantly aid investigators to fight crime and keep offenders from continuing to commit more crimes. 60% of offenders are repeat offenders and are linked to more than one crime. We have laws in place that will allow DNA to be taken on, if we have laws in place that will allow DNA to be taken on arrest and that DNA is processed in a manly, timely manner, investigation workloads and prosecution workloads will be greatly enhanced. It is hurting our ability to provide public safety when 2,740 DNA offender samples sit waiting in our crime labs to be processed and input into the system. Had Kenneth Dion's sample been taken in February 2003 by the New Hampshire prison system, countless hours in Bonnie's case could have been spared, but like many states, their backlog and their laws prevented it from happening until 4 years later. Bonnie's case is extensive. There are more than 12 volumes of information that have been collected over the years. New people have been assigned to the case, and countless hours sifting through that information has cost our state more than $200,000 just since 2003. That would put it more than 100 times what it would cost to input DNA. in the 2,740 samples sitting there, more than likely there will be at least 25 investigations aided and possibly solved. I have copies of information on the amount of samples that they expect per week is 68 new samples per week. So within no time at all, these numbers are growing. Currently, Alaska has 10,982 offender profiles. In 2005, we had entered 6,027. 2006, we entered 1,374. Currently, year to date, in 2007, we have entered 2. It is unbelievable how our crime lab has been overwhelmed with the amount of casework and can't even get to the profiles to input them. Yeah. I've also got a list of our Alaska HIP summary. Investigations aided just in the last year have been 64 investigations. There have been 18 cold case-to-case HIPs, 32 case-to-offender hits, making it a total of 50. There are total, that's cold hits. Warm hits, there's been 7 case-to-case, 19 case-to-offender, making a total of 26 warm cases. A grand total of 76 hits have helped investigators and aided in the investigations. I have spoke with Colonel Audie Holloway, and he supports a time limit on the amount of time allowed to process and enter the DNA samples. They are a critical part of the investigation of crimes, both for the victims, the public, and for those who are looked at as potential suspects. We need to set standards of what is acceptable. In London, England, turnaround time was 45 days in 1991. They considered that unacceptable. By December 2003, they had reduced it to 5 days. Currently, their turnaround time is 1 day. To be effective, we need to set standards and ensure the information will be input. 60 days is a good start. 60 days should be our goal. In Bonnie's case, more than 80 DNA samples were taken from potential suspects who were ruled out because their DNA did not match. Investigators then knew to move on to look for other suspects. DNA will save time and money. It's costly and irresponsible and heartbreaking to allow the backlog to continue and not to act. Give our law enforcement and our crime lab the tools they need, the funding they need, the compensation needed to hire and retain good people. Thank you.
Ms. Foster, thank you very much. Senator McGuire has a question.
Thank you. Actually, just more of a comment. I just want to thank you, Bonnie, and I know you've been working with Chris and others, and you have all the statistics that you put into the record today that I got over the weekend, and thank you for being It's a sad case that you ended up having to be the hero, the reasons behind it, but we're lucky to have you in our community. And then I have a conference committee on 90-day session, so I just said that to the chairman. I support both amendments, but I want to put into the record for Lauren to hear that I think there is a real problem going on that needs to be addressed. And so when this bill first came before us, the hesitancy I had was, we're going to expand it, and yet we know that we have over 2,000 DNA buccal swabs that are not inputted into the database. And I knew that, and it's kind of one of those ugly little secrets that's out there that's going on. And so I am calling upon the Commissioner of Public Safety to take action, and I believe it could come in two ways. The first is I think there needs to be better education to the police officers that are out, not just the troopers, but the ones in the municipality, about how they effectively take these buccal swabs in a timely manner. There's much evidence and much discussion that that the folks out in the street don't have that professional training They don't, in many cases, know what they're doing, and so they're not taking those buccal swabs in a timely manner. That's issue number one. Issue number two is the direct issue about backlog. And what I'm asking for, and I already discussed with the chairman, is that this bill contain a fiscal note for a criminalist. And it could be a 1, 2, or 3. I don't care. But I know they need a full-time criminalist in that crime lab. And their job every day from morning to night should be to get those DNA samples into the system so that we can get this backlog done. And I do know that there is $1 million grant that's sitting out there that has been given to the state for this very purpose. So in reality, the fiscal note might be met by that very existence. But I think it's important to put it in because I don't want that position to be sort of floating with the tide. When we have the grant money, we have the position. When we don't, we don't. So I think it's something that needs to be set in stone so that the crime lab is supported. So those are my thoughts, and just thank you to Ms. Foster, and I support both the amendments. And
thank you, Senator McGuire. And let me also say that Senator Bundy, who has had some hand in this bill, is with us here today in the audience. And Ms. Foster, I think you know that he sponsored a bill on this subject. He's been an absolute gentleman about letting his bill be put into this one because the way the bills are poised, it's far more likely that this bill will pass and become law this year than trying to get a Senate bill through the House. So thanks to Senator Bundy. At this point, I will remove my objection to Amendment Number 3. Is there further objection to Amendment Number 3? Hearing and seeing none. Oh, we have a comment. Yes, please. Ms. Carpinetti.
And I think DPS actually.
And DPS. Okay, before we, yep, let's get it all on the record. Very good.
Actually, I think DPS probably should start.
For the record, my name is Lauren Rice, and I am the legislative liaison to the Department of Public Safety. We support the amendment. We appreciate Senator Wilikowski's efforts as well as Senator Bundy's efforts in bringing this forward. We want the 90-day limit. We understand the need for it. To address Senator McGuire's questions on the record, we do know about the federal grants, and I have David Shade on the line who can speak more to that. And our fiscal note, should the amendments pass, will include 4 lab technicians. So we are committed. The 2 changes that we're asking for in this, just to make sure we have a smooth transition in implementing it, is for this particular section to have a effective date of 2009. And I have Michelle Collins from the Crime Lab online to testify. Typically, even if we recruit for this position immediately, which is unlikely, we need at least 6 months to train that individual and get them up to speed, and then after that, they're still being supervised. It's very important that things are exact, obviously, and that the lab technicians know exactly what to do, and that's why we take a lot of care in training them. And so, although we want the effective date of the collection to be immediate, we just ask that the 90-day requirement to have it processed be 2 years. The other change that we're asking for is on line 8, after shall, the language make every effort to. And the reason is because we are committed to processing these DNA samples, and I appreciate Ms. Foster's advocacy and her support of the crime lab and her understanding of our backlog and what we're up against right now. She has a very solid understanding of what we're doing, and we appreciate her support. Our concern is that should a lab technician be out for some reason, should he be in Bethel testifying on a case and be unable to come back, oftentimes they're away for a week or more testifying on cases, or if there is a critical piece the equipment, a critical piece of the equipment or the technology that we use, should it be broken or should there be any problems, we would be in trouble if, for instance, we get it out in 96 days or 91 days.
Thank you, Ms. Rice. And I think the suggestions you're making will be incorporated into a CS that we'll put together for the bill. Ms. Carpinetti.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, we also had a suggestion after the 90-day limit. I think Senator Wilikowski, after our conversation, I think he means it, the 90-day limitation, to apply to samples taken from an individual and not samples taken from a crime scene evidence. And because that takes months to sometimes process. You could do something like, say, collected from a person under B1, B2, or B6 of this section on line 8 after the word collected, so that it's clear that we're not talking about a 90-day limit on crime scene evidence.
I'll let you work with Senator Wilikowski to get the language just the way you like it.
Right.
Other comments on the proposed amendment? Hearing and seeing none, I'll again remove my objection. Is there further objection to it, to amendment number 3 as written currently? Hearing and seeing none, amendment number 3 is adopted. And that brings us to the next amendment. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move amendment number 4, which in the upper right-hand corner is version 0.4 lookup dated 5807.
And I'll object for the purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment is tracks a bill that was filed by Senator Bundy, and I think there are some minor differences, but essentially what this does is requires that that DNA samples should be taken from a person charged in a criminal complaint, indictment, presentment, or if there's information with a crime against the person, or a felony under AS 11 or AS 2835, or law or ordinance with elements similar. And I believe there are some minor changes that may be requested, but the essence of this bill is to get immediate DNA samples from those who are indicted for felonies. And there is a provision in here such that if a person, upon court order, has been adjudicated to be not guilty, that the information should be destroyed. So we believe there is a safety valve to protect civil rights. That is the bill, or the amendment, rather.
Questions, comments, discussion? Department of Public Safety, have any perspective on this amendment?
Yeah, Chairman, we ask that the language be changed from charged to arrested. And the reason for this is because currently our APSIN system is set up with an interface for arrestees, but not for individuals who are charged. We're not notified when an individual is charged, and this is just a change that allows this to be implemented without a computer system overhaul.
And
I think Ms. Carpinetti may have a different opinion on this, but
Ms. Carpinetti.
Well, I think there's really two ways to look at it. Taking it at a criminal complaint means that usually somebody has reviewed the elements of the offense and the evidence and has filed a charge. It's a little bit one step removed from an arrest. But the practical problem with doing it at a criminal charge is what Ms. Rice has just suggested. DPS doesn't know about when a person has been charged, and there are two more practical problems. If people aren't arrested and they're just if you peg it to a charge, they may be summoned into court. They may never be arrested. They come into court, they answer the charges. There's nobody there to take it, and if there were, there would be chain of custody problems with the evidence itself. So I think there are advantages to the way it's drafted, but the practical problems are big. So I'm sorry I'm not very helpful. But I guess I would support DPS just because of what our current absence situation is and how it would actually work in terms of you'd have to set up a new system of gathering the buccal swabs from people charged that are not arrested and then figure out a way to get it to the police in a way that would be upheld in court.
Let's just talk through it while we're here. It's clearly easiest to give the buccal swab to a police officer who knows for a certainty that he's arresting someone and he knows what he or she is arresting that person for, whether it's a crime against a person or whether it's a felony under AS 11 or AS 2835, et cetera. So it strikes me that that's what we're aiming for, is the arrest.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely the most practical, the easiest way to do it.
And frankly, it seems to me that with the 90-day, with the idea that it's going to take a few days to get to that, if the charges are later dismissed, tossed out, or he's found innocent, it's likely that that'll happen before the sample is actually processed. So there'd be that opportunity to pluck that sample out of the pile, if you follow my thinking, and that person never has his DNA analyzed. So I guess I'm just asking how we write this now to get what we all agree is, or it seems like what we all agree is the way to go. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple things. Number one, I it would seem to me that we can change charge to arrested, and that will probably solve the problems. But I guess what I would suggest is that I can work with the law and with public safety and try to come up with adopt this amendment, but then we can try to come up with a CS in the interim. The way I'm thinking of this is like a fingerprint. When you're arrested, you're taken in and you get your fingerprint. And this will be simply adding another step. And this is not something that's unusual. It's not something that is unique. This is something that is done in many other states. Many other states where there are arrests, there are DNA samples taken. It's a simple process. It's not very expensive. And so I'd be happy to work with the group organizations here and try to resolve this. But it seemed to me we changed charge to arrested, and that solves one problem.
Yeah, it just doesn't quite. I agree. It takes care of a criminal complaint, but the word indictment probably doesn't belong there now. Presentment, I'm not sure even what that is. Information, I know what that is. But it makes the structure just read, I think, a little bit strangely. Senator Bundy has a thought.
Yeah, may I make a comment?
Please, come forward.
You can
sit at the table if that's easiest, or whatever's easiest. Senator Bundy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. And I'm pleased to hear the discussion going the way it is, because I certainly agree with Senator Wilkowski that it should be done, and with you, Mr. Chairman, at arrest.
Mr. Chair, could I just make a comment here? I think this is the first time Senator Bundy has ever agreed with anything that I've said.
Well,
I'm looking out the window to see if certain animals are flying by.
I would refer you to a CS for Senate Bill 33 that I have had drafted, and it does include the term arrest. And absolutely in agreement with Senator Wilkowski, that it's like being fingerprinted. It's a 21st century version of the fingerprints, and of course it's only used for serious crimes against a person. But when you are arrested for, it's a given, you're fingerprinted now, and surely it's not a huge step then to go on to the DNA sample.
And just the only caveat I have to toss out there is that the only difference, of course, is that in a security breach, if my fingerprint gets out in the world, that's one thing. But in a security breach, if my DNA gets out, my family could suffer adverse consequences from a medical insurance and other aspects. So that's just my only caveat. And I think otherwise it points to wealth.
And if I might, Mr. Chairman, respond to that, I think there are federal laws that require, and perhaps you have people that will from the crime lab be able to testify, that the type of testing of DNA they do is I would use the term very unsophisticated, shallow. It does not get into medical history. It's just enough for identification, but it doesn't go into all our unique genetic makeup. So
thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, I don't think it would happen through the testing mechanism. Is there some strange possibility that someone might want our DNA? I don't think this would open that door very wide, if at all, because they certainly, if there was something nefarious going on, take DNA off your coffee cup right now. So.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. Thanks for being here. Let me make this suggestion. I will remove my objection to Amendment Number 4. Is there further objection to Amendment Number 4? Hearing and seeing none, it's adopted. Senator Terrio?
Well, do we, again, need to do so with some latitude so that the words can be?
The next step is to put this bill aside for today, and then but let me just finish. The amendment's adopted. Amendment Number 4 is adopted. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on HB 90?
If I might offer this, I have a copy of the of the CS that may be helpful as you write your CS.
You either hand it to Ms. Carpinetti or to my staff or to Ms. Senator Wilkowski. I think the circle's been completed. Thank you. But just as a matter of housekeeping, there's no one else here in the audience that wants to testify on HB 90.
I would like to say something.
Ms. Foster,
Foster, go
ahead.
Currently, there is federal money in there to deal with the backlog. The money has already been allocated to Alaska. The only issue had been that the people at the crime moral lab were told they couldn't do overtime. If they were given the opportunity to use those funds and do overtime, we could probably handle the backlog very quickly. I know Oregon handled their backlog with those funds, and they were inputting more than 1,000 DNA profiles in per month.
Ms. Foster, thank you. Is there anyone else online who would like to testify on HB 90? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony, and we will set HB 90 aside for a future hearing to go over a CS. Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, before you do it, just a question on Section 2. And Section 2 modifies language that was just adopted in Senate Bill 140 in the previous legislature, which you actually had separate legislation dealing with. And I'm wondering why it is that this language has been recast so that on page 2, lines 25 and 26, we're dropping out, as described in AS 41 and listing things here. Just structurally, what was the reason? And my apologies if you discussed that before I came down.
Actually, we did not. Ms. Carpinetti, can you shed some light on the construction of lines 25 and 26 on page number 2?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, the acts described in AS 1141, 455A, 1 through 7 are similar to the acts described in paragraphs A, B, C, D, and F. And it was, I think the reason it was drafted this way is to make it clear that it's you can, it violates the statute for an adult to, send depictions of another adult or him or herself, because our sex prosecutors in the state find that people do that to children. They send pictures of themselves, and this is just clearer language than 41 to make it clear that it's pictures, depictions of both adults and minors.
Okay.
My review of the list in AS 41, 455A, 1 through 7 reveals that that's exactly the same list that we now have just enumerated, Siri Adam, here in the bill.
That's right. It's no substantive change, but the way 455 is drafted now, you can argue that it only applies to depictions of children doing these particular acts.
I see.
Thank you, Ms. Carpinetti. Mm-hmm. Further questions or comments on the bill? Then we'll set it aside. Okay. We do have 118 before us today, but I see that person stepped out of the room, and we have the sponsor of SB 95 poised and coiled. So to the victor goes the spoil, Senator Bundy, and we do have folks waiting to testify, and that's also a reason for letting them step in front.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and as you say, poised and coiled, we have this agreement going with Senator Wilikowski, and I want to continue that in that vein. Mr. Chairman, I apologize for being repetitious for some of you that have heard this bill before. This is a bill requested last fall. As you know, Mr. Chairman, the state does a lot of business with small businesses throughout Alaska, and small businesses, I think many people agree, are kind of the backbone of our economy. The state doing businesses at many levels encourages people in their economic activities, and in order to get the state the best product at the best price, we have competitive bidding. The competition seems to serve both the business and the state well. I was surprised when Mr. Foster approached me and said, well, this competitive bidding applies in many, many cases except for the printing of ballots. And I suggested that perhaps we ought to look into that and why that exception was carved out. It did not seem that it's something that we should do. It was hard to believe that there could only be one printer in all of the state that could do ballots, plus it also seemed as if that one printer were unable, it would be good if there were other people who were could, in the furtherance of their business, gear up and print ballots. As I understand it, the Division of Elections isn't enthusiastic about this bill, but they're not opposing the bill either. Their big concern was that the bill might require them to go through the complete procurement process, which could be cumbersome in a light of elections and the turnaround that they need. The bill does not call for that at all. It calls for the division to develop internally their own procurement process so that it would allow for competitive bidding. And when they finish, they may continue with the current printer. They may find other printers. I don't know. But as I say, a bill by request, and as I'm not a printer, I know Mr. Patrick is online and perhaps some others that could shed more light on this bill for you. So with that, I'd be available for questions.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. Questions or comments for the bill's sponsor? Hearing and seeing none, we do have Patrick Foster on the line, who's been waiting some time. Mr. Foster, are you out there?
We're still here, yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record, and then we'll go ahead and hear your testimony.
Sure. My name is Patrick Foster. I've been working in the print industry in Alaska for nearly 30 years and currently work at AT Publishing and Printing here in Anchorage. I am here in support of Senate Bill 95 because I believe it's unfair that the Division of Elections sole sources the printing of the state election ballots to a single shop on the Kenai Peninsula when there are many printing companies in Alaska fully capable of printing the ballots. The state of Alaska uses the Diebold electronic ballot readers for the purpose of tallying results for the statewide elections. The Diebold requires printing companies who print ballots destined for their machines to be certified by them. At the time the state of Alaska adopted the use of these ballot readers 8 or so years ago, no companies in Alaska were certified. Shortly thereafter, a small company a small Alaska printing company was certified by the Division of, and the Division of Elections has been handing over this $300,000 print shop to this company ever since. This is done despite the fact that a number of other Alaska printing companies have voiced a desire to be included in the process. As a side note, my company, AT Publishing, became a certified Diebold printer in 2003. I'm aware there's probably a certain comfort level the Division of Elections has in working with a printer that has proven to do a decent job. I make a living trying to give my customers that same comfort and recently succeeded in a ballot printing contract that we have here in Anchorage. The municipality of Anchorage went through 5 election cycles sole sourcing the printing of its 160,000 ballots with another printer before the decision was made to put the printing out to competitive bid. The municipal clerk was admittedly concerned moving forward with a new printer, but has since found the change relatively easy, and the city has benefited by paying less for the ballots. My company has been printing those election ballots for the last 3 years for the municipality of Anchorage, from what I'm told from the city, that they will be putting out, they're happy with the service and the product that another printer's given them, and they will be putting that contract out for bid again this year. I'm certain the State Division of Elections would develop a fine working relationship with any other printer that they found to print those ballots. Some might suggest the complexity of the Alaska ballots is reason enough to leave things the way they are, but nothing's really further from the truth. The task of printing a few hundred thousand ballots would be daunting for some small shops, but they wouldn't bid on this project anyways. There are, however, many companies in Alaska, I feel, fully capable of handling the volume of work in the time required and handle the packaging and shipping logistics as well. As printing jobs go, the ballots are fairly easy to produce. They do require careful imprinting and packaging, but nothing beyond the scope of many jobs by dozens of printing companies handled each year. One other concern at the Division of Elections could be bogged down with putting the ballots out to bid each election cycle. I might recommend that each bid be awarded for one election cycle with a performance option for another one. So that would give Division of Elections the ability to go 4 years before between putting that out to bid each time. Opening the election ballots to competitive bid would have a variety of positive effects, including the probable savings of a substantial amount of money by the state. Also, the money spent by the state might be spread around a little more to other businesses. That level playing field would open the door for more Alaska printing companies to be involved, giving them the opportunity to upgrade their facilities and improve their standing in the industry. Additionally, the state would not have to put all of their eggs in one basket, relying on just one printing company for the printing of their ballots. This concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. Questions for Mr. Foster? Thank you for testifying this afternoon. I'll note for the record that Mr. Kendall waited a long, long time to testify. He had to go back to work, I imagine, or other pressing business. We do have a letter from him in the packet, and so that's become part of the record. I've noted in the previous hearing on this bill that this is a bill which is, I think, satisfies the absolute mandatory minimum for work required for the drafter. There's one word in there that's switched from may to shall, and everything else stays the same. I do have a question. Would this bill require that each election be competitively bid, or could you select could you put out a two election cycle sort of package, if you will, an RFP, and then pick someone to go through a couple of election cycles?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. As I stated, the Division of Elections would develop their own procurement competitive bidding process, and certainly that's within their purview, and I would guess common sense would say they would look for a volume discount, if you would, rather than just per
election. You probably wouldn't go per election. You'd go for a year or something like that.
But that, again, would be in their purview.
And should they decide to break it up by region, they could do it that way as well.
See no reason not.
Senator Willikowski.
Page 3, lines 30 and 31, we're adding, looks like, a section. Am I misreading this?
I believe that's just renumbering.
Okay. That's just renumbering.
Is that right? I didn't mean to jump in.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct.
Thank you. We have Jason Hooley here from the Lieutenant Governor's office. Mr. Hooley, thank you, Senator Bundy. Thank you, Ms. Alberts. If you'd like to come forward, put yourself on the record.
Yes, sir.
Can we fix your tie? You fixed it. We'd be happy to hear your testimony.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jason Hooley, Office of the Lieutenant Governor. And just briefly, we spent the hearing in Senate State Affairs talking about some of the concerns we had and why the product that we currently have we thought was a good product. But in looking at the bill and talking with the sponsor, we think that this bill and the language is a workable solution, and we're happy with there.
That's a fantastically succinct testimony. Thank you, Mr. Hooley. Questions or comments for Mr. Hooley? Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else online or here in the room that wishes to testify on SB 95? Hearing and seeing none, I'll close public testimony. Is there discussion amongst the members?
On a motion?
Please.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move CS for Senate Bill number 95, State Affairs version, with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes out of this committee, and on to the next.
Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, the bill's moved from committee. Let's take a short recess. We're back on the record. And next up is CS for House Bill number 118. Here today to present the bill is Mr. Pawlowski. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Pawlowski. Please put yourself on the record. We'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Pawlowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. House Bill 118 started off, as a lot of bills do, when the sponsor was walking door to door and hearing from a lot of his constituents that one of their primary concerns were the recurring parties that happened in the neighborhoods. And we went back and did some research looking at what other states have done to give police a tool to deal with these rather large parties that happen often on the weekends. And what we saw was several cities or municipalities or counties or boroughs, and even some states, had enacted something called social host laws. What we did was put a bill together that said it is illegal, or it's a non-criminal violation, to recklessly allow a person under the age of 21 to possess alcohol in your dwelling. We looked at Alaska statute and found that, well, it is against the law to rent a hotel room to provide alcohol to someone under the age of 21, and it's illegal to provide alcohol to someone under the age of 21. After talking to the police, we realized that there's nothing about hosting a party for them. And what the peace officers and police officers often find is that when they show up at a party, they're often left with nothing they can do to the person that's hosting it. And that can be because proving that someone knowingly furnished alcohol to a minor can be fairly difficult and time consuming. So on balance, what we looked at was something that was easy for the police officers to use, easy for the judicial system to work through, and would provide a fairly serious deterrent to people that are throwing parties for underage people. And that's, in essence, Mr. Chairman, a $500 fine and a non-criminal violation. That's House Bill 118. You'll see in your packet, particularly some of the studies that say the number one place people under the age of 21 find alcohol is at someone else's house. And we believe this bill will be a valuable tool.
Thank you, Mr. Pawlowski. Questions for the bill's sponsor, Senator McGuire.
Yeah, I do. I have a question. So it sounds like from your sponsor statement that you believe parents, you know, I just was saying to Hollis, the unruly teenager. I hope Grayson isn't unruly, but I've sure met a few, and my brother was one of them. But if a parent, if you're possessing alcohol in the home and you're a teenager, the parent can't be charged.
Mr. Chairman, if you can, Representative McGuire through the chair, this is something that was talked a lot about as we went through the process. And you'll see on, I guess, page one, the only page, line five, the word physically was added. And the reason that was is that the intent of the sponsor and the intent of the legislature was that a parent in absentia or someone else wasn't responsible. It was the person actually physically in possession of the dwelling and exercising dominion and control over it. So if a parent's absent and their child is throwing a party, their child is the one who gets the fine.
Okay, I'm trying to understand that just real quickly, because the second scenario that I have concerns about is the friend of your unruly teenager who comes over to your house, and I see that the mental intent is reckless, but I don't know, is it reckless that you have a bottle of wine in your wine cabinet that's not locked and right out in the open? Is that reckless? I mean, are we going the way of guns, or I don't know. I'm not disagreeing with the policy. I think it's terrible to have minors drinking. I do not disagree with the policy, and I've supported Representative Meyer's bills with respect to the purchase of alcoholic beverages and so forth. But it's just you're really starting, the government is really, I just want us to all recognize, I mean, in the past couple years, we just every day where the government is just reaching into that house. I mean, it's I worry every day that I'm committing some, breaking some law that I don't even know about. I mean, we're really starting to become a nanny state. And it scares me a little bit that we're just reaching right inside that family home, and we might have some unwitting recipients of this violation. I don't know.
Senator McGuire, through the chair, that's something that's been talked a lot about as the bill's gone through the process. One of the reasons we chose recklessly and not criminal negligence or another standard was that it's aware of and consciously disregards the risk. And it also, if you look at the definition of recklessly, which you'll find in 421.080.3, the risk must be of such a nature and degree that disregard of it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of conduct that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. And when we've talked about the issue that you've brought up, because the comparison to guns has come up several times about this bill, remember, it's not the person who is the tenant, it's not the person that's the landlord, it's the person that's in possession of the dwelling at the time of the offense that occurs. So the police show up and they see it and the person's physically in possession. That is the person who's being reckless, not the parent in absentia that let things open. Oh. So that's the difference that the physical possession thing is so important to us, is that we want it to be at the moment the offense occurs.
Thank you for the clarification. And thinking along the lines of Senator McGuire, you know, it just strikes me that 9/10 of these will be committed by a teenager whose parents are out of town, who invites his friends over to party at the house while the parents are gone. That's sort of the paradigmatic nightmare of all of us parents who leave town from time to time.
That's right.
And you know, so you know, I'm not physically in possession of the house when I'm gone. I'm not exercising dominion over it when I'm gone. Chances are it's the person, you know, and let's just, for the purpose of this discussion, hypothetically say my teenage son were to do this. Okay? He'd be the person who'd be physically in possession and exercising dominion control of the house. He's the guy that opens the door, closes the door, says, you know, come on over. So he gets cited for this, having hosted a party at the house, and I'm down with that. I think it's a good idea. He should pay some penalty. Although, I guess I have to note, chances are he's also going to get cited for minor consumption, right? Minor possession.
Mr. Chairman, we hope that he would, yes.
Right, right. Now, it may be that for whatever reason he's able to run away, and the cops see him running away, and they, you know, they can't prove he was consuming, but they get him when he comes back home, or I get him when I come home. All hypothetical. And so that takes care of the teenagers, but chances are they're going to be up for a MCA. Adults who host these parties, you know, I think that's a little more criminal, a little more culpable, worse from most of our perspectives, that you'd have a 21-year-old hosting a party with teenagers. But why wouldn't that be contributing to the delinquency of a minor?
Mr. Chairman, it should be. And the hope and the key in those situations is that we would charge with both. The reality of it that we've heard from public safety is that often they're more concerned with ensuring that people don't drive, trying to keep the kids from running away, and the gathering evidence and then prosecution is very difficult. We find, and the sponsor firmly believes, that for your, say, 21 through whatever early age group that's throwing parties for underage people, several $500 fines in a row really will hit that person very hardly. And this is a tool for the police to very easily say, you have this violation, and when we can prove it, we're going to get you for furnishing as well. And that's the kind of conjunction that we hope works out. But we find they often can't prove furnishing, so we'd like to give them something to use.
Thank you for that clarification. Senator Terrio.
I just want to check on the situation. If you have invite your neighbors over to dinner, you're having dinner, their 19-year-old, you know, college-age student is there, has a glass, is invited at dinner to have a glass of wine with everybody else at the table.
Oh, yeah.
Is that, you run the risk of being running afoul of this too, because you have recklessly allowed the underage person to have the glass of wine. Now, that's probably, there's not going to be blaring music and cars parked all over the place that draw the attention, but I'm just wondering, is there anything to differentiate that situation from the raucous party?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, using that example, and I think the important part of that example is that the minor's parents are accompanying them, and it's not in a licensed premises. And you find that exemption in 4.16.51, that this section does not prohibit the furnishing or delivery of an alcoholic beverage by a parent to the parent's child or guardian or someone else. So if two families were to get together outside of a licensed premises, and that person's parents would give alcohol to their own children, even though the alcohol was provided by another parent, I believe that would be covered under that exemption. I believe Annie can talk about that too, but from Department of Law. But that's the idea, is that a parent has the right to give their child alcohol. Now, the policy call that the sponsor didn't want to get into was does another parent have the right to give another person's children alcohol? And that's something that you'll see in your packet, a letter from the Red Ribbon Coalition that is, in fact, very concerned about parents throwing parties for other kids' children, particularly around prom and graduation and things like that.
Senator McGuire.
Yeah, this bill is the kind of bill that it's just interesting. Again, it's the government trying to decide individual family decisions that are made, and it's one of these great Venn diagrams where you know who you're trying to get, and that's a great circumstance, but then you have all these unintended consequences that occur that are a result of, you know, perfectly arguably good intents. And you know, I was just sitting here thinking about when I went to Spain and lived as a host student. You know, in Europe, the whole attitude toward alcohol is completely different. I mean, wine is served with dinner, and their philosophy is that we're crazy, by the way. I mean, they think that holding out and making all these laws is what makes us, you know, drink poorly. But so I'm sitting here thinking in my mind, so what if you have a you know, and then there's this other part where you have, you know, till 18, we sort of understand that. I mean, we sort of understand a 14, 15, 16-year-old, 7, we go, oh, that's awful. But then you reach that point where you leave for college, and you could even be an advanced kid and go to college at 17. And so then you come back home for that first Christmas. And yeah, I mean, I think the custom in a lot of families is that you're a college student, you're a freshman year, you might have a glass of wine at Christmas dinner. And so I'm just, you know, I'm well aware of the mental intent of recklessly, but it's aware of and consciously disregards a known risk. I don't know. I don't know what a known risk is. I don't know if keeping a bottle of wine that's sealed is the appropriate thing, or what if it's open and you didn't drink the whole thing, but so you've got a cork in it? Is that a known risk that you're consciously disregarding? And then if your kid comes home with a couple friends from college, which I did many times, brought friends home, and you offer them a glass of wine, or they ask for a glass of wine, I don't know. I don't know.
Here's what I'm going to do. It's a interesting bill. It's a good bill. The Senate Resources Committee starts in 5 minutes. Let's hold this bill over till tomorrow while we can all sleep on it and think about the possible ways that our children and ourselves can go wrong if we pass this into law. We're adjourned.